The Orange FM.
Ready to form Voltron. Activate interlocks. Dinotherms connected. Infracell up. Mega thrusters are go.
Welcome, Voltron fans, space explorers, Super Sentai robot fans, collectors, toy enthusiasts, and comic book readers. Welcome to the 21st episode of Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. That's right, the podcast has just turned 21, and as a rite of passage, it's now old enough to drink. And why wouldn't we? We have much to celebrate in the 30th anniversary year of Voltron, Defender of the Universe. So raise your glasses. And let's toast the big guy while we sit back, relax, and take you through another special Let's Voltron podcast episode with another amazing guest who has brought life to this world of Voltron and all the characters, planets, espionage and politics, relationships and heartache, action and intrigue that you've come to know from these great Voltron stories. We'll introduce you to our guest shortly, but first, there's some current events we need to catch up with. And I also have to tell you why we are not doing an episode review podcast this week. I know I said during the Voltron Fangirls Roundtable episode that the next episode we would be covering would be an episode review of the next four episodes in the Voltron Defender of the Universe series. Although I had planned on doing that, what you will be getting is even better, I promise you. In less than 2 weeks, you will have that episode review of episodes 9 through 12 in the Lion Force series. But I will be having a special guest help me with that. See if you can remember who this is.
If World Events is interested, I would be more than happy to come back and write more Voltron stories.
If you guessed Dan Jolly, then you are correct. We had him as a guest all the way back on our 7th episode when we talked about the Devil's Due comic series he wrote. Now we will have him joining us to review four episodes from the original Voltron series, including the Go Lion comparison, as usual. You won't want to miss this episode with Dan Jolly coming later this month. Now, you all know you listened to the last episode that Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast, is currently offering podcast logo t-shirts in a limited time campaign on teespring.com/Let's Voltron. The last possible time you can order a t-shirt will be July 17th at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So go to teespring.com/Let's Voltron and order a bunch, because if we don't reach 50 shirts sold, then nobody who ordered will get their t-shirts. We have three styles that come in all sizes, so the kids can get some too. There's gray unisex, gray women's, and oatmeal unisex tri-blend. Use the drop-down menu on the page to select the style and size you need. If you're one of the ones who already ordered, thank you so much for supporting the podcast, for seeing our posts up on Twitter and Facebook, the Voltron forums on Voltron.com, and from our email. Now, as an investor who reserved your own t-shirt, we need your help to spread the word as the last few days of this campaign come to a close. Form Blazing Fans, once again, to spread the word to the four corners of the universe so we can reach our goal of 50. And these t-shirts will be the hottest collector's item in your Voltron arsenal, I promise you. We want to highlight two items that are up for sale at Voltron.com.
1, 2, 3, 4!
For the first time ever, Denver, The Last Dinosaur, the complete series on DVD. All 50 episodes in one place. This 6-disc special is a pre-order that will ship on September 16th. Anything else ordered with this item will ship then. Everyone who purchases from store.voltron.com will be entered into a drawing to win a Denver statue. Drawing will take place on September 16th and be announced on the Denver Facebook page. Also on store.voltron.com, they are now accepting pre-orders of the Toynami 30th Anniversary Voltron Collector Set once again. No word on when these will ship yet, though, But if you missed your chance last time around, now's the time to get it. At the end of 2014, there won't be any more chances to get it. If you have any questions about previous orders or when this item will ship, contact WEP at WEP.com. That's W-E-P at W-E-P.com. Now, I'd like to introduce you to a comic book writer who started it all in 2003. He's written a number of comics for several publishers, including Marvel, Arcade, Dynamite, and DC Comics, and has published over 300 columns. His first creator-owned project, The Many Adventures of Miranda Mercury, returned as an original graphic novel from Arcadia Entertainment in August 2011 to widespread critical acclaim. He is the writer of both Voltron and Voltron Year One for Dynamite Comics, which we will be covering in great detail here on this podcast. He's a self-proclaimed Voltron fan, and we are pleased to welcome Brandon Thomas to Let's Voltron. How are you, Brandon?
Oh, I'm doing great, Mark. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm just doing great. I got to tell you, there were a lot of people excited when I announced that Brandon Thomas was going to be on the podcast.
That's good. That's good. I've been I've been appreciating the support for the book, even though the book you know, finished its run a while back. There's still a lot of love and a lot of support out there for some of the things we did over our run, and you know, I really appreciate that on behalf of the rest of the creative team for the book.
So what's been keeping you busy lately since the book has been finished?
I'm working on more Miranda Mercury, which you just mentioned. Volume 2 is officially in production. The first issue is completely drawn. The second issue is the layouts are almost completed and it's about to go to pencils. And we're really excited about continuing the adventures of Miranda and Jack Warning and seeing what happens with their story going forward. So I've been working on that mostly, and I've also been nursing a secret project that I can't really say much about, but it'll be a lot of fun, and hopefully it's something that will be announced in the coming months.
All right, so when's the first chance for someone to get a sneak peek of the new Miranda Mercury?
It'll actually come in a couple of weeks. We're waiting to get the first sequence of the first issue locked down, and then we'll probably be putting that online and revealing who our new colorist is going to be for volume 2. So we're really, really excited about it. Lee Ferguson and I, who's the co-creator of the character, we learned a lot putting out volume 1, and we're basically going to put all those lessons to great effect in volume 2. So we're super excited to get it out there, and it has what we call our Empire Strikes Back cliffhanger to give you some type of idea of where the story might be going. So we're pretty excited, and it'll probably hit sometime next year. We're still looking over our options and deciding whether or not we want to go the traditional print route or if we want to do something digital. So there's a lot of things that we're kind of discussing and trying to really lock down.
And that's not something you had to think about the first time around, right?
Well, we did. I mean, digital wasn't as big of a factor or a platform as it is now. But it goes into some of the lessons that we learned while putting out volume 1. So digital is a landscape that offers a lot of advantages for creator-owned indie projects. And we're basically going to be exploring, you know, every option possible. So you might get another original graphic novel like we did with volume 1. You might be getting single issues. You might be getting digital, might be getting the book serialized online. So there's a lot of different things that we're discussing and trying to determine what the best path forward is.
Are there any changes in the way that comic books are getting promoted these days?
I know, well, clearly social media is a huge, huge factor, especially when you're producing a book for one of the larger companies, and they have a very limited marketing budget and marketing goals. And so it really falls to the creators of the title to essentially spearhead and drive the kind of press coverage that a book is getting. Sometimes you can't rely exclusively on your publisher to do the lion's share of the marketing, because right. there's so many titles that are coming out, you know, from so many different companies. And as creators, if you put out a creator-owned book, that's part of the deal. That's part you have to understand, and you have to accept that you're going to have to work, you know, twice or three times as hard to get the word out about your project versus when you're, you know, working for another company. And
right.
In regards to Voltron and Dynamite, you know, Voltron, you know, Dynamite basically handled the marketing for the book. And right. to get a title like The Many Adventures of Miranda Mercury into, you know, half as many eyeballs as the Voltron work got, you have to work really hard, and you have to really have a solid plan, and you have to incorporate it into, you know, what needs to happen in order for the book to not only survive but to thrive out there in the marketplace.
Well, is it even harder the second time around when you're doing your second installment of Miranda Mercury, right? You had fans from the first time, and now you got to say, all right, everybody, come on back now. Come on back.
You know, we have this idea. It's probably false, but we have this idea that the second time will actually be a little easier, but we don't know whether or not that's actually going to be the case. So we'll see how it all goes. But the thing that we're excited about is that anyone that could actually get their hands on the book seems to really, really, really have enjoyed it. So, you know, our goal for volume two is to not only progress the story and progress the characters, and to, you know, to put together a more what we think is a better, more streamlined package, but to also make sure that the word about the book travels a little further than it did for volume one. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's the more of it you do, the more serious you and your project look to consumers. You know, sometimes it's easier for people to take a chance on something that there are already two or three volumes out, you know, already published. You know, it looks like something that is going to continue and is going to, you know, keep coming back in the future, and not something that people will get completely invested in and will kind of disappear, which sadly has been the story of many an independent project over the years. So right. you just want to let the people know that you're serious about the project and about the characters and about carrying it forward, and that you're going to stick it out, you know, long term. It's not going to be something that you just, you know, you kind of come in and do a couple of issues and then no one ever hears about it again. And I think that in regards to our project, you know, volume one ended in a cliffhanger. So clearly, you know, we have grand designs for Miranda Mercury. So we're really excited to get more stories out to people and, you know, kind of extend our reach out into the marketplace.
Well, when you want to get in contact with your fans, you have your own blog you've been updating steadily for like over 5 years now, The Fiction House?
Yes, yes.
So The Fiction House is about comics, writing, music, anything else of potential interest that comes to mind. Now, do you interact with fans there, or is that primarily an outlet for everything you?
I do some interaction. I think I probably do more interaction through my Facebook page and also my Twitter feed. I'll have a little interaction on the blog when I post a long form column that kind of generates some some controversy or, you know, some praise even.
So how did you get started writing comics?
I got my start in comics by writing a weekly column called Ambidextrous that was basically a chronicle of me trying to break into comics. So that's basically how I made a name for myself when I was starting out. That is usually people's first encounter with me was writing that column for so many years. So I still have I do kind of feel like an old man just because I did it for so long. So now I'm like, oh wow, like I remember when I used to write these weekly. Like, I had so much more energy than I did now. But
did you have a mentor that you looked up to that may have, helped you along the way?
Well, not directly, but Warren Ellis wrote a column, a very famous column for Comic Book Resources called Come In Alone. They actually collected some or all of his run into a book. But Come In Alone was basically the column that made column writing look cool and important to me. So I would say that that was one of the inspirations for starting my own column.
Okay. And around what time did you start doing some freelance work for like DC and Marvel?
I started in 2003. My first assignment was for Arcade Comics, which was a company that was started by Rob Liefeld. I don't know if anyone remembers, but years before that, there was a miniseries called, I believe it was called Youngblood Year One, that was announced that Kurt Busiek did plots for. And for whatever reason, it never released. But in 2003, Rob was doing a Youngblood miniseries with Mark Millar called Youngblood Bloodsport. And he went back and found the Youngblood Year One material and renamed it Youngblood Genesis and wanted to release it as a companion series to Bloodsport, kind of like the past and the future of Youngblood. So he brought me in to do final scripting for that project. And that was my first published work. And a big reason why I did that was because Mark Millar had started reading my column, Ambidextrous, and had gotten in touch, and I completely, geeked out all over him when he did.
Well, that must have just floored you when somebody contacted you about your work.
Oh, yeah, I had no idea. That's one of the lessons that I learned early on from doing something like that. You, for better or for worse, you never know who's reading. So you always have to keep that in mind whenever you post something. And he had been reading the column, and he kind of endorsed me a couple of places when I was getting started. So he gave me a really nice recommendation and endorsement to Rob. And so Rob, called me up one day. I mean, I think we had traded some emails back and forth over a few months for projects that, either didn't happen or didn't get quite to publication. But he contacted me out of the blue and he said, I need you to script this project, and this is when I need it done, and it'll be on sale 2 weeks, and it might have been 3 weeks. It'll be on sale in 3 weeks at Comic-Con.
Okay.
So it was a whirlwind few weeks for me, working on the final script for this book, and then flying out to San Diego and being able to actually sit behind the table for the first time. So after that, I did some work for Marvel. I did a Fantastic Four series. I did a Spider-Man story for their Spider-Man Unlimited anthology series. I did a fill-in issue of Robin for DC, which was quite an honor because the Tim Drake version of Robin is by far my favorite DC character.
Okay.
Next to Batman. They're kind of neck and neck. When I was getting into comics back in 1992, they had just introduced Tim Drake as the new Robin. So that was one of the characters that I kind of fixated on. And I'm like, oh, I can go back and I can find all of this character's first appearances. And, it'll be really easy to do that for him and versus some of these older characters that have been around for a lot longer. And it was literally impossible for me to, go back and collect like the entire run of Amazing Spider-Man. But, Tim Drake was being introduced in the books at the time. And I love Chuck Dixon as a writer. And he was writing a lot of the kind of like the important kind of formative Tim Drake stories.
Right.
I fell in love with that character. So it was really cool to get to actually write an issue of Robin.
Did you get any feedback from people who were big Dick Grayson fans at the time?
No, not much. I mean, at that time, Dick had his own book.
Right.
Dick had been Nightwing for a little while, and I think he had gotten to the point where people were accepting him as Nightwing instead of, you know, calling for him to be Robin again.
Right.
I think a lot of fans had accepted, you know, the fact that Batman was going to have, you know, new Robins occasionally. So, but I was a big Dick Grayson fan too, but just not like Tim Drake. It was just kind of the perfect thing for me to be coming into comics and to have this, you know, this new character that had just been introduced. And it was really easy to get up to speed on all of his first appearances and formative stories. And I think I have almost every single issue of the Robin series that DC put out.
Okay. Now that you've done some work for both DC and Marvel, who would you say has your favorite characters?
I would have to say Marvel. I think that overall, DC has my favorite character. You know, I think Batman not everyone's favorite character, but DC may have my favorite character, but I think Marvel has they have a deeper bench.
Okay.
As far as I'm concerned.
Gotcha.
It was great. It was great working for both of those companies, and I got to interact with a lot of great people, and I got to get better, and it was it was an honor. It was awesome.
Okay, you had mentioned Comic-Con. Are you planning on going to Comic-Con in a couple weeks?
Oh yes, absolutely. I'm actually in the San Diego area now, so this will be my second year going to Comic-Con as a local. So it's a very different experience than the, you know, flying in from Chicago and staying at the hotel. You know, I actually get to come back home and sleep in my own bed every night.
That sounds great.
Oh, it's fantastic. I can't even it's hard to describe how different it is. So I have a friend, good friend coming in from Chicago. He's going to stay out here at my house for a little while, and we go to the con together. We have for years, and you know, I love it. I mean, I know it's insanely busy. I know it's overwhelming for a lot of people, but you know, I still enjoy it. I enjoy, you know, seeing people and friends that you only get to see once a year or that you interact with online. So I just, you know, it's like a reunion,
right?
It's like a reunion. So
is there one panel in particular you're looking forward to this year?
I'm probably going to check out the 24 panel just because I'm a huge 24 fan. So
you love Jack Bauer, don't you?
I love Jack Bauer. I do. It's true. I think they're going to do a big kind of retrospective panel this year. So I'm looking forward to that too. And I think the full schedule will be coming out pretty soon. So,
right.
You know. I always end up with a big list of things.
I just got the email that shows all the different Star Wars related panels that they'll be doing there.
Oh, excellent.
Star Wars Rebels is leading the pack there.
Excellent. Yeah, I think Del Rey Books is giving out advanced copies of that, of the novel that's going to be like the prequel to Star Wars Rebels. So that's kind of on my list of things to go stand in line for.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm pretty excited about it. Star Wars. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about this a little later, but you know, Star Wars is responsible for a lot of my Voltron material in weird ways. So
yeah, well, Star Wars came in 77 and Voltron came in 84, and I gotta say it came at just the right time because that's when Star Wars was ending in 83 with the mm-hmm. Return of the Jedi, and then, you know, to pick up Voltron right after that was awesome.
Yeah. See, I had no idea. I think I was first introduced to Star Wars probably, and I would probably say 86, 87, at my grandmother's house. She had Star Wars on VHS, and she gave it to me, and she never saw it again. she never saw that VHS copy again, and it was just, you know,
it kind of disappeared, huh?
It did disappear, and that's basically my, you know, that was what sparked me. You know, Star Wars is what made me want to be a writer, want to tell my own story. So I got into Star Wars then, and mind you, I had no idea that there were sequels or that the story continued at all. I mean, I think it was probably a year or so before I think my parents were trying to let me, you know, experience the first one as much as possible before telling me that there were other ones.
Right.
Which in hindsight, I find really mean and cruel now, but they didn't immediately, you know, get me on to Empire Strikes Back. They let me kind of, you know, experience Star Wars for a really long time before saying, hey, you know, by the way, they made another one. What? So between Star Wars and Saturday morning cartoons, you know, I was pretty much gone after that. It's like, oh, okay. I think I'm gonna try to be a writer. I think that's what I need to do with myself. I think that's what I need to give the world. So,
okay. Well, you've certainly been involved with Voltron fans over the last few years. You were on panels for Voltron at Comic-Con, and you participated heavily on the Voltron forums while your issues were released.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how important has that relationship with the fans been for you as a writer?
It's very important. I mean, to me, like I said before, even though the book has completed its run, those fans, I still interact with those fans, you know, on a regular basis, and right. They still really appreciate some of the things that we did in the books. And I thought it was important because part of what I wanted to do when I wrote the books, for better or worse, I didn't want to erase the original animated series. I mean, there was some discussion about, you know, essentially doing like a, you know, like a Voltron Begins. And part of that actually happened in Voltron Year One, which we'll talk about a little later.
Right.
But it was important to me not to erase all of that. You know, I wanted the series to occur after events that we had all seen in the, you know, in the original cartoon. And because of that, you know, I thought it was important to really engage the hardcore Voltron fans. I wanted to please that hardcore fan base more than anything.
Wow.
Because I know that they really had, just like me, they had a, you know, they've had a connection to the material from very young ages. And I understand how important and how formative some of these things become to us. And I wanted to honor and I wanted to acknowledge that. So that was something that I always enjoy doing, you know, going online and kind of talking about things in the book and kind of explaining or in some cases defending some of the choices that we made. So, I mean, I thought it was important. And I think that the fans that I was able to interact with online and at shows, I think they appreciated that. And I think that's why people still fondly remember, you know, those Dynamite comics, which was my goal from the beginning. You know, I just wanted, however long they lasted, I wanted people to have fond memories of them.
Oh, I got to tell you, I looked forward to every Wednesday when they would come out on comic book, you know, every Wednesdays when they do the new releases.
Uh-huh.
So I looked forward to that every time it came out.
Yeah. Yeah, it was exciting. I mean, it's exciting to have, you know, to have books come out. I mean, as a writer or a creator, there is always some anxiety attached to the process, especially since things that are coming out in stores were actually produced 5 or 6 months before then.
Right.
So that kind of contributes to a little, you know, a little anxiety because you feel by the time the book actually gets in your hand, you feel so far, you feel like that you're past it. Like I always felt, you know, I always felt like I was so much better than, like, you know, the issue that had just come out. You know, right. I always felt really great about the last script that I had turned in. And in some cases, you know, I was four or five scripts ahead of what you guys were saying.
But right.
It was
that's
it was,
tough.
Yeah, yeah, but it's, you know, it's part of the process, you know, and it's just something that you get used to, and the more books that you have that come out, the more comfortable and kind of at peace you are with the whole process. But yeah. I mean, I loved it. I enjoyed going to the shop, and it was a new issue out, even though I had seen it, you know, I'd seen the proofs, you know, it's always different to actually get the physical thing in your hand.
Right. So when you agreed to join us as a guest on the podcast, you threw a little teaser out there on Twitter for the fans. Do you remember what you said?
No.
You said, "Also, just FYI, feel free to ask about some of the things I had planned that you guys never got to see."
Yeah.
So we can tease that a little bit more and save it for later. Because we're going to start talking about the Voltron comics you wrote, okay?
All right.
Now, can you tell me what your earliest memory associated with Voltron was?
Well, I always refer to it as there are three cartoons that to me are my own personal kind of holy trinity, and that's Voltron, Thundercats, and Transformers.
Okay.
Now, those three actually have a lot of similarities, but Voltron in particular was always, you know, there's just something about giant robots fighting monsters. I mean, it's hard to explain what the appeal, you know, what the actual appeal of that is, but I think it's something that stays with us even through stuff like, you know, Pacific Rim or the recent Godzilla. There's just something exciting about that. And I, you know,
it's not difficult to explain to another fan.
Yeah, no, I mean,
not at all. But, and I can tell you, everybody that was watching Pacific Rim was saying, "Oh, that could be Voltron."
Yes, like this should be Voltron. Why right. isn't this Voltron? Maybe one day it will be Voltron, but I just remember watching the show after school. I can't for the life of me remember what channel I used to see it on, but I actually don't even know if I was catching the first runs or the reruns, or you know, cartoons back then, they just used to come on and disappear, which was also traumatizing for me, realizing that you would get to the end of something and it would just never come back ever
right.
again.
There wasn't so, that information overload that you have today.
No,
you know exactly
yeah,
about everything.
Yeah, I know. I know everything. I know, like, you know, the names of all of the creators and writers and the schedules, and, you know, the DVR is full with stuff. And it wasn't like that. It's just like it came on and it was exciting and you watched it and you just hoped it came back on again. So Voltron was always one of my absolute favorites, just because, you know, the robots, the monsters. I always loved the team aspect of it. A big Commander Keith fan from the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Which anyone that's read the Dynamite stuff can pick up on, that I am a huge, you know, a huge Keith fan, and yeah. He is easily my favorite character. That's just my thing. For some reason, I always like the leaders. It's weird, but
that was the one question that Ted Koppler had asked us when we had him on the podcast. He said, mm-hmm. "Who's your favorite character?" I'm like, "Keith."
Yes,
it's gotta be Keith.
I mean, come on, what kind of question is that?
Right.
But
so
yeah.
You had said in some other interviews that you had done, you had said some of your earliest writing was about Voltron, but you never saved it.
No, I didn't save any of that stuff, which was, I feel like it would be kind of interesting, but probably also really, really humbling. Like, wow, I've gotten a lot better. But that's one of the things I used to do. You know, I used to write in between episodes of my favorite shows. So Voltron, Thundercats, Transformers, you know, I always used to watch an episode and kind of ask myself, oh, well, you know, well, what if this happened?
Right.
And That was kind of, I didn't know I was doing it at the time because I was, you know, I was much too young to even really fully comprehend what I was doing. But that was, those were my first stories. Those were my first kind of exercises and plotting out stories. Like, you know, what would happen if this happened?
Do you think some of your early works would fit into the fan fiction realm alongside the rest of the Voltron fanfic writers of today?
I don't know. It probably would. It probably would. I mean, it's really, I would like to think that the stories that I'm telling now are like a little different than, you know, than the ones back in 88, but who knows? I might have actually thought of all of this stuff that I did when I was 8 or 9, and now I'm just doing it now. But I don't know. It's really hard to say, but I remember the act, you know, I remember doing it for years and years. You know, I remember, you know, plotting out Star Wars Episode 7, which is so funny because, I mean, I never thought that we would ever, see an Episode 7.
And neither did I.
And we're living in a world where it's being filmed now. It's so strange and surreal in certain ways. And I know that when the first time they release, you know, a trailer or something for it, I'm going to be in some kind of like nerd induced coma for days. You know, the first time, you know, I see like the first frame of like old Luke Skywalker, it's just going to be, it's going to be overwhelming.
What I'm so proud of is the fact that I can hand my lightsaber to my son. He's 11 years old and he's going to get to live, you know, being part of that history where a new Star Wars trilogy is being made.
I know it's amazing. It's amazing to, you know, to fathom and to recognize that now there's going to be a whole new generation of kids that have, you know, a completely different experience with Star Wars than we had. I mean, that they've already had a different experience with things like the Clone Wars and, you know, a lot of the, you know, the kind of expanded universe stuff that's out there, but it's pretty exciting, you know, as a hardcore fan, it's pretty exciting to see. I always have a warm, fuzzy feeling for Star Wars, just because I acknowledge that as kind of the start of where I am right now. You know, I don't,
right.
You know, maybe something else would have come along that would have connected with me as intensely as that did, but you know, but I can never know that. All I know is that I saw Star Wars on VHS on an old TV at grandma's house and I was gone. You know, I disappeared down like the rabbit hole and, you know, and this is where I am now as a result of that. So
you took the blue pill, huh?
I did.
All right. So can you tell everyone how you were approached for writing Voltron comics for Dynamite?
Well, I was already working on a project with Dynamite that actually never released, but I was already in contact with them, and we were working on something else, and the announcement came out that they had gotten the Voltron license. So naturally, I said, "Can I pitch for it? Can I pitch for it?" And they said, yeah, you know, you can pitch for it and, you know, keep it short. So I typed up my best, you know, page of, you know, kind of like my premise for a Voltron series. And I sent it in and they liked it. And then we started having deeper conversations and I wrote a lot more. I plotted out, you know, the first arc and then the first year and then the first year and a half. And there was a little back and forth. And basically that's how it happened. It was relatively painless, probably because I already had my foot in the door. You know, we were already working on another project together. I think they already had a pretty good idea of, you know, kind of like my relative skills, you know, whether or not I could hit my deadlines, what kind of scripts I would turn in. So when the announcement came that they had Voltron, I jumped on it immediately. I'm like, I need to be able to pitch this. And thankfully they said yes. And pretty much the rest was history.
which story arc came to your mind first? Was it that Six Pilot story or the Ten Lions story?
It was the Six Pilot story was the first thing that I pitched. What I did was I kind of like 75% of the pitch was that sixth pilot story. And then at the very bottom, I put little bullet points of things that came after the sixth pilot, like, you know, with the evil Voltron and, you know, some
Motor.
Yeah. And some of that stuff. So I think that's probably what caught their attention, that I wasn't just pitching them five or six issues, you know, that I was pitching them 18 issues, you know.
Right.
And so that was actually good and bad, and we'll get to that a little later. But it was pretty seamless. The people from World Events Productions, you know, of course they were heavily involved, and they really liked the kind of stories that I was pitching them. And we had a couple of meetings on the phone to just go over some things and kind of what comics we liked and what we wanted this comic to be like. And my kind of tagline for my entire pitch was actually Generation Voltron.
Right.
Which that's what I felt was kind of like the overarching theme of what I wanted to do with the book, to basically honor and acknowledge what had come before and continue in not a different direction, but to continue the stories and the characters forward. I didn't want to go the whole kind of, you know, Voltron Begins route, you know, which is it's kind of like the path of least resistance,
right?
To do, you know, to basically reintroduce everything,
right?
But at that point, I wanted to go forward, you know. It was important for me to carry everything forward. And one of the big kind of thrust of my pitch was that I wanted the space explorers to be as dangerous and as capable outside of their lines as they were when they were piloting them. Because even as a kid, that was something that always bothered me. I always felt that, you know, the Lion Force team, they just weren't, you know, they didn't seem like as, you know, they weren't as cool when they weren't in their lines. And it was always something that just kind of bugged me, even as a, you know, like a 7 or an 8 year old. So when I got the chance to actually pitch it, that was one of my my main pushes, that these guys, you know, are incredibly dangerous and capable in their own right, which makes them even more dangerous when they get into their lines. So.
Right. It's almost like you wanted them to be so good at what they do as space explorers that when they get in the lines and they're contained in that cockpit, you're almost like saying that, oh, man, I wish I could do more than just sit in this cockpit.
Yeah. Because to me, that made more sense to me that, you know, there's something that would be almost a little confining, you know, to them about the lines. But, you know, that's just kind of one of the main things that I tried to bring to it. One of the things that was important to me to kind of express through the stories.
So you were given a pretty open canvas for creating these stories, with the original cartoon being the only canon that you worked around, right?
Absolutely.
So with the year one, you were doing a prequel. With Voltron, you were doing post the cartoon, right?
Yes. Yeah, so I was basically working from both ends of the cartoon. So after we had gotten a couple of months into the main Voltron title, it had done the first couple issues came out and they had done really well. And Dynamite, you know, wanted to explore doing a prequel, and so that actually gave me an opportunity to go back and do kind of like that Voltron Begins story. But what I did was I started before they were sent after Voltron. You know, I wanted.
So you were writing both of these at the same time?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I think I wrote the first year one script after 3 or 4 of the main series. So yeah, so I was writing both series at the same time.
At any point, did you say to yourself, "What did I get myself into? This is too much"?
Well, you know, if you, yeah, I don't know if I'm even supposed to tell people this. People that read Voltron Year One, a lot of that story is about Sven being overwhelmed by kind of leading this team. And kind of being overwhelmed about the expectations of his position and how he's supposed to be as a, you know, as a commander and a leader of men. And, you know, a little of that was me at the time, to be honest. You know, a little of that was me trying to trying not to crash and burn.
Trying not to fail.
You know, working on both of these stories. And it was, you know, they were both very, very, very important to me. And once I got the opportunity to do Year One, that gave me the chance to introduce some characters and concepts that I could then pick up in the main title later on down the line.
Okay.
So it was a pretty exciting time. But if you read Year One and it's basically Sven trying not to have a meltdown by, you know, everything that he has in front of him, this kind of what he sees as like an insurmountable task, there's a little of me in there too.
Right.
There's a little of me writing scripts for two Voltron series, you know, one taking place before the series and one after, and, you know, just trying to, knowing that it's that it was a big responsibility. And knowing that, you know, making sure that I was giving everything the attention and the time and, you know, the hard work that it deserved.
Well, I wanted to point out that on your website, The Fiction House,
mm-hmm.
That you had, when you finished both books,
mm-hmm.
you had said that a special thank you to all those people that were involved.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to, is it okay if I read that little section?
Yeah, you can. Absolutely.
Okay. You thanked everyone involved in both comic series on your blog when you finished with Dynamite. You said, "Thanks to my fellow creators and artists, Ariel Padilla, Craig Cermak, N. Stephen Harris, Marcelo Pinto, Adriano Lucas, Marshall Dillon, Simon Boland, and the phenomenal cover artists that got people to pick up the book in the first place, Alex Ross, Sean Chen, Admira Wijaya, Wagner Rice, and Jack Herbert. Additional thanks go to Nick Barucci and Joe Rybant, the guys who put us all together. They were a joy to work with and were always willing to let me tell the story I wanted to tell. Hope to work with you all again sometime in the near future. And thanks to Jeremy Corey and Tiffany Alardi, who made me feel like some kind of big-time writer guy by flying me out for signings and putting me on the panels at giant conventions." So let me start with one person who just stands out in that whole group of people.
Mm-hmm.
When did you find out about Alex Ross doing covers on your comics, and how did that make you feel?
Oh, well, what happened was, I believe Alex had done a couple of covers already before Dynamite had even announced the series. I think he had done the covers to maybe one or two issues. And so what happened was I'm working on plots. I think this was probably before I had even gotten to scripts yet, or I had done one or two scripts. And my editor, Joe Rybant, contacts me and he says, you know, Alex wants some ideas about things to draw on upcoming covers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty amazing. That was I felt pretty good about myself that day.
That you were influencing Alex Ross.
In the afternoon that email came through, you know, I felt pretty good about myself. I have to admit. So it was a joy. I mean, so we sent a lot of ideas back and forth. You know, some of it he used, some of it he didn't, but I mean, all of the covers were gorgeous. Even after he left or he departed, Sean Chen took over And you know, I was always happy about how, you know, the book looked and the work that everyone put in on it. And it was just, it was amazing to actually be able to say that I had a comic with the Alex Ross cover on it. You know, I have this art book, you know, the Dynamite one and the DC one. So it was, it's surreal. It's hard to even explain how that was, you know, to get that request. Like, oh yeah, you know, Alex wants, you know, he wants to know what he should be drawing for the next few Voltron covers. So it was pretty cool. Pretty cool.
All right. So now I want to get into this first comic.
Okay.
And I want to ask you one of the first things that just, you know, jumps out at me. How long had you thought about making Zarkon a human with a family trying to protect the Earth during the time of first contact with alien species?
You know what? I don't know. It was just the first thing that came to me when I started the pitch was Voltron speaking. And everything kind of evolved out of that kind of idea, like Voltron speaking and Voltron having some kind of sentience and what that would mean for the character, for the space explorers. And it was just one of those things that it seemed insane. It was one of the things that I thought of, and, you know, I pitched it and I'm like, oh, they're never gonna let me do that. Like, that's, you know, that it's just insane. But, you know, to their credit, they did let me do it. And, you know, it was one of the things that kind of was an extension out of this idea of making the space explorers dangerous, making them a little more like, you know, kind of like special forces operatives, and kind of this whole idea that once Earth, you know, contacts other planets and other, you know, races, that the space explorers were a response to that.
Right.
And what kind of stories would come out of that? You know, what kind of stories would come out of Earth learning that they were just a much smaller part of a bigger kind of, you know, universal tapestry.
Mm-hmm.
So in trying to, you know, I really wanted to make the series about kind of the relationship between three planets, you know, Earth, Eris, and Doom, and making Zarkon initially being a, you know, a human being who later becomes Zarkon and later becomes, you know, the king, the ruler of planet Doom, was it was a larger extension of that. It was a way of making him a little bit more connected to everything, because coming his origin starting on Earth and then going out into space on this voyage that completely transforms him into something else,
mm-hmm.
and putting him on Doom gave him it seemed to make him more connected to the overall story that I wanted to tell. And I didn't want to just have him be the bad guy. You know, I didn't want, you know, to have him be the bad guy for no reason. You know, I wanted to try to put in a justification for attacking Eris. You know, I didn't want it to be so arbitrary. So I wanted to, you know, I wanted to insert a reason that Zarkon would, you know, that he would hate Eris,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and having him be a, you know, a normal human being on Earth and encountering, you know, Eris in kind of like a first contact scenario was just something that I thought it was a pretty interesting twist on, you know, on the original stories and the original backstory. And I also wanted to make Eris a little more mysterious, a little less
innocent.
A little less innocent. You know, I wanted everyone I wanted everyone to be involved, and I wanted everyone to at least have some responsibility for kind of the way things were and the way things ended up. And Zarkon was, you know, he was a way to basically, he was a way to essentially put blood on a lot of people's hands.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I thought it made sense to me. I mean, it was crazy, and I was curious to see if they would go for it, but they knew where it was going. Ultimately, you know, unfortunately, the readers only, you know, didn't get to see the entire kind of arc of the story.
You
but
mean like the third sphere?
Yes. Big things. But it was, I was, the to me, the most nerve-wracking thing was turning in that second script. You know, to me, the script for issue two was going to tell me whether or not Dynamite and World Events thought I was completely insane, because that issue is almost entirely Zarkon on Earth.
Right.
You know, going through his own struggles and his own difficulties, and kind of being crushed with this responsibility of having to protect the planet.
And then
from some threat,
he opens up to his son Zach.
Yes. So when I turned in that second script, I have to admit I was a little anxious about it, but they absolutely loved it, and so that kind of gave me the, you know, it gave me the push to kind of keep going for it instead of kind of retreating from that story and kind of like making it a little less important and a little less prominent. But you know, to their credit, they gave me some really great feedback, and they were really supportive, and they let me roll with it.
Right. Now, a very important character that you created for this, and I'm not sure, is there a long, detailed backstory for Alex Sigis?
Did I pronounce that right? Yeah, I pronounce it Sigis, but I'm not sure. I mean, I made it up, so people can pronounce it however they like. It's fine. But there was going to be a pretty extensive backstory that we got to learn about him. Through his kind of tutelage of Keith, basically, as he and you saw some of that in the Ten Lions story.
Right.
This idea that that Sigis begins training Keith in some you know, kind of like some magical defense spells, and kind of broadens his you know, kind of blows his mind a little bit at kind of some of the larger things that are out there in the world. And it was very important. It was also very important for me to have both the magic and the technology aspects, you know, and not have one completely run roughshod over the other.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a Voltron story without both.
Exactly. So, that was going to be, we were going to see a big backstory for him, and we were actually going to see the reason why his spirit became trapped on Earth. And yeah, there was a whole glorious epic story about you know, about Sigis and his backstory on Eris, and basically how he got, you know, the assignment to be the one to go to Earth to let them know that the world was larger, far larger than they ever thought. So
yeah, I always wondered what were his motivations when he meets Dr. Elliot Zarkon for the first time, and how is it that he speaks for Eris?
That was a really fun scene to write. That was one of my favorite scenes, actually. The interrogation scene in issue three, where at the end he turns the cell to water, and the water just kind of, you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of runs out into the rest of the room, you know, while Zarkon is telling him that there's no such thing as magic.
Uh-huh.
So it was I liked that character a lot, and I had some big plans for him down the road. And part of there's one little thing that I kind of started to introduce this this kind of secret connection and relationship between him and Zachary Zarkon. Mm-hmm. That was going to that was kind of like a slight clue to what his kind of motivations and backstory was ultimately gonna be. You know,
that was going to be my next question.
Yeah,
I was going to ask you, why would Sidious get so close to Zarkon's son Zach, knowing what could happen to Zarkon's family?
Yeah, that was going to be a big part of his backstory, and basically the fact that he had to give up certain things when it was decided that he was the one that was going to go to Earth and approach them about Doom and, you know, and open their eyes. So his relationship with Zach was actually, it was going to pay off later on down the road when you meet, you know, when you meet Sidious's actual family and the, you know, the things that he basically had to forsake for Eris. So it was going to be a whole thing.
Okay. A whole thing.
Yeah.
All right. So is there something inside of Dr. Elliot Zarkon that was leading him to ruin even without his family being
killed? I don't know if it was what I wanted to express was that there was a kind of a darkness and a frustration in him that, you know, kicked in the wrong direction, ultimately led him down this road. But I don't think that, I think that if we had, that if Eris had basically left him alone, he probably would have been fine.
Okay.
In the end. And I think that that's something that kind of explained his kind of anger at what had happened to him. Because I think he honestly believes that if he had never met Sidious, if he had never heard of, you know, the planet Eris, you know, they would have been fine. You know, whether or not that's true is another thing. But I think it's mostly true. You know, I try not to write him as someone who was already evil. You know, I tried to write him as someone who could be pushed over the edge, or who could be pushed to a certain point where he would, you know, where he would transform. You know, I guess I don't think I had started Breaking Bad yet when I had wrote it. But, you know, kind of the same principle, taking, you know, a normal kind of ordinary man and kind of transforming and mutating him into something completely different than what he started as.
Like Michael Douglas in Falling Down.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, like the nice guy that gets pushed too far. Uh-huh. So. You know, those are kind of the things that we definitely wanted to play with. And again, I wanted to make him more important. I didn't want him to just be the bad guy who just, you know, growls at, you know, Urak and Merla. And, you know, I wanted something different for his character. You know, right. I wanted him to be more integrated into the story.
All right. So, The Voltron Force members, particularly Allura and Pidge, seem to have a battle between each other, you know, one-upsmanship, you know, kind of thing.
That was fun. That was actually one of those things that kind of happened on the page just when I was actually writing the scene. It just occurred to me, like, oh, you know, it would be fun if Allura and Pidge kind of had this little, you know, this little rivalry, this kind of like banter with them back and forth. And I loved writing Pidge too. I got to do a little more cool stuff with him in Voltron Year One, but yeah. I really loved writing Pidge. I mean, writing him was a lot like writing Jack Warning in the Miranda Mercury series. Just young, kind of like overly talented, kind of accelerated emotional development, you know, whether that's good or bad. And, you know, a little sarcastic, a little smart ass, you know, a little, you know, he had a bit of an attitude problem, which is always fun to write, characters with attitudes, you know. When I had a lot of fun with Lance too.
Right. What was it about Lance and Keith's interaction that you liked the most?
I just like the antagonism. I just like the fact that I think that they're both, you know, they're both very, very close. They're both very good friends and brothers, but there are just certain things about the other one that kind of drives the other one nuts. And so, you know, getting to play with that relationship was pretty exciting because even though I am a huge, you know, Commander Keith fan and, you know, Keith can do no wrong, I really did develop a fondness for Lance. The more that I wrote Lance and Keith together and Lance with other people, the more, you know, the more time you spend kind of writing the characters, the kind of more sense they make to you, their interactions and their relationships. I mean, I was really looking forward to having Lance leading the team. And that was one of those things that I was able to introduce as a plot point in Voltron Year One because I was writing them both at the same time. You know, I always had this idea that Lance would get some time, you know, in the commander's chair. So when I was doing Year One, I was like, oh, well, you know, maybe it would be interesting if Lance is the one that's next in line.
Right.
You know, he's next in line to lead the team and he gets skipped over, you know, maybe for the right reasons, maybe for the wrong reasons, but he gets skipped over. And that's something that also informs his rivalry with Keith.
Now, I had a quick question about that, and I know we're jumping ahead here, but The whole thing with Sven being the commander and everything, and then knowing by the end of the story that you have to get Keith to be the commander somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the skipping over Lance thing. How did you work that out?
It was tough. I mean, just like with Zarkon, I tried to look for characters that hadn't been fully fleshed out or fully developed in the original animated series. So then I wasn't, I mean, some people might say that, you know, I violated some rules of the core canon, but I tried to find characters that, you know, would allow me a little more latitude. And Sven was definitely one of those characters. I mean, if there's one kind of aspect of what, you know, what I was able to do over my kind of my entire 18 issue run, I feel proudest of the stuff that we did with Sven, because he was a character that was always kind of, you know, abused and kind of like the redheaded stepchild of the,
yeah.
You know, they basically kicked him out of his lion so they could, you know, get Allura onto the team faster. And so he was one of those characters that, like Zarkon, was kind of like a very kind of basic archetype, but not much had been done with his backstory. And so that was one of the first things I came up with. I was like, oh, okay, well, let's do this story that explains why this squad of space explorers pulled that assignment. And the, you know, the twist to that is basically that they wanted to get rid of them. You know, they thought that the Voltron mission was essentially a suicide mission,
right?
You know, and I wanted it to be that this team learned some sensitive information. You know, they uncovered evidence of this kind of grand conspiracy that the Galaxy Alliance had been up to, and they were a problem. You know, they were a problem for them, and this was their way of basically getting rid of them.
Right.
You know, not believing for a second that they were going to come back with Voltron. So,
and it made it very believable too.
I mean, I tried to. There are a couple of things, to be honest. There are a couple of things with Keith that I might do like a little differently to make it a little more explicit or overt that he's going to end up leading the team. But I think we struck a pretty good balance. In the way kind of we depicted his interactions both with Sven and with the rest of the team. I thought it was important that he had a special connection with Sven that no one else did. And he knew things about his commander that he kept from the rest of his unit. And then that played into what I was doing with him in the main title, where he was essentially keeping secrets from the rest of his team. So there were just little kind of character traits and kind of character moments that, you know, I was able to put into both books. And, you know, Sven was a huge part of my year one story, and he was going to be a huge part of the main series down the line, even though I gave him a new face and a new identity.
Okay. So going back to the first comic, at one point, we're at Castle Doom, and somehow Sven makes it into Castle Doom, and he's able to have a full conversation with Zarkon. Before he shoots him 19 times. Okay, I counted every single one of them. There was four in the first panel, and then there was an individual panel for each other shot.
Yes,
19 times. Why 19?
The number specifically doesn't have any special meaning, but it did need to read like overkill. I mean, in the original script, it's just like, we should have a panel for every single shot that's fired, and it should be a lot of them. I don't know if I actually asked for 19 panels or if I just said it should be a lot of panels and it turned into 19. I honestly can't remember, you know, but I'll take responsibility for it. I'll say it was all me. But, you know, I just thought it, you know, I wanted to do that thing. I wanted to make sure that people knew he was going to be dead.
You know? Oh, we saw the body after that. That was pretty dead.
Yes. Yeah. And that was actually in the original script, too. It's like you have to make sure you see the body because, you know, with comics, you can never tell. You know, everybody's always coming back from the dead. You can. I wanted it to be explicit that was going to be the end of Zarkon. And
I couldn't even believe that there were some fans that asked you if he was really dead.
And that was the reason that the entire first storyline was dedicated to him, because I knew he was a goner at the end. You know, I knew that the kind of mantle was going to move on to Lotor, and we were going to do some interesting stuff with him too down the line. But yeah, it was probably overkill, but you know, I wanted to convey Sven's anger at him.
Oh, you did.
I wanted to make it clear that, you know, that he was dead, that he wasn't going to be coming back. There was going to be no, you know, return of Zarkon story. That was basically going to be the end of him, and we were going to move on to something else.
All right. At what point did you find out that you were going to have to close up the series before the final issue was due? And did this take a lot of work, knowing that you were thinking along a more like a 20-issue story?
Yes, it did. I think I found out around issue 10. So we were pretty far in. I was pretty far into that second arc when they basically said, it was like, oh yeah, you know, sales are kind of trending down, so let's try to wrap this up in a couple of issues. And they were, you know, they were really supportive about it. And they asked me, you know, basically like, can you wrap this up in a couple of issues? So it wasn't, you know, they didn't slam the door on my foot. It wasn't like I turned the script in and they were like, oh, well, this is going to be the end. So I did have a couple of issues where I knew that the book was going to be ending. And I have to admit that did make those last couple of issues a little more kind of aggressive than they were initially. I mean, a pretty good example of that is, I believe it's at the very end of issue 10 that you learn that Merla is piloting, you know, basically like the evil Voltron.
Yeah, your steampunk Voltron, right?
Yeah, the steampunk Voltron. Well, initially, that reveal wasn't going to happen until much later. But knowing that the series was going to be, you know, was going to be ending, you know, a little sooner than I expected it, it basically encouraged me to kind of let go of some of the secrets that I was holding on to for later. I mean, the
11th issue was all about the secrets between Keith and Allura, right?
Yes. Yes, it was. That was a big, that issue didn't change too much. I mean, Keith was always going to shoot. Was always going to shoot Sven at the end of that particular chapter. So not too much changed in that one, but issue 10 and 12 changed quite a bit. Like in the 12th issue, we basically, there was a reveal that Lotor might be on the same side as Keith. And that was another thing that I was going to save until way, way later down the line. This idea that Lotor also wants to, you know, take on the third sphere as much as, you know, Keith and Sidious do. Right. So that was also another little kind of thing that I was holding on to. But once we got to the end, it's like, oh, I'll just put it in there. It doesn't matter now. It's like, I can tell them now. But ultimately, that's kind of the direction that the series was going to go into. There was going to be an uneasy alliance between Keith and Lotor. And there was going to be a giant epic kind of Voltron war that included, you know, our Lion Force favorites and Vehicle Voltron and a couple of other new units.
Yeah, that was one thing that a lot of people were interested in, because you had teased that it was going to be Vehicle Voltron.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? That's something else that I didn't know at the beginning. That was something that I think probably right when I started to really kind of plot out that sixth script, which is basically the Zarkon Sven conversation before he shoots him 19 times.
Yeah.
You know, it occurred to me, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I want to tell this story that, you know, introduces a couple of new Voltron units. You know, it would be pretty cool if I could sneak Vehicle Voltron into this story. So I was pretty excited about that when I came up with that little idea. I thought that the fans would get a pretty nice kick out of that. But the plan was always for Vehicle Voltron to come into focus and have an epic team up with you know, our Lion Force guys and some other new characters.
Now, also, when we go to year one, we're talking about Sven being the commander and knowing that you're eventually going to have Keith as the commander. Mm-hmm. That was a sort of a keystone of that whole series.
Yes.
Going to the year one series, where we're just talking about the Space Explorer 686.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole lot of new elements here that we wouldn't have seen from a Voltron force that's defending the universe, because it's just a commando team with regular missions that are in the planet's interest, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So these guys actually have significant others that they're involved with, like Hunk.
Yes.
Is it a girlfriend or a wife that's pregnant?
Well, I think she's a fiance by the time the series ended in 12. So that was something else that... that was fun to do, because when I came up with that with the other team of space explorers that Sven's girlfriend Katrina runs,
right,
I didn't realize at that time that was going to end up being, you know, Hunk's fiance. But the more I wrote them together, and I had there's a really funny interaction with them. And I think it's the fourth issue. It's the issue where they basically have like the team up, but our guys are up to something completely different that uh-huh. the other team isn't aware of. Basically what happened was we had that page where it's like both teams of five members like sitting across from each other, and they're basically kind of sizing each other up. And, you know, the character that will become Hunk's fiance, you know, is kind of looking at him like she's a little interested, you know, kind of like she likes what she sees. And Hunk seems kind of confused uh-huh. by that. And after the art for that showed up and I saw exactly how that moment played out visually, I was like, oh, well, I'm going to make her Hunk's fiance in the main series. But when I initially introduced her, I didn't know that she would take on that role later on down the line. It was once I saw the art, and then once I just saw the way that the artist Craig Cermak kind of played their interaction, it made sense to me. And it was also kind of funny in a way too, that they would end up together, you know, given how this is basically like the first time they met each other. And it was a very different situation than it ended in Voltron 12.
All right. Well, at this point, we have some questions from the fans, and are you ready for anything?
Yes, I'm ready for everything.
Okay. All right, so our first three questions are from Grant Birchmeyer.
Oh, I love Grant.
Okay. His first question is, if I remember correctly, you've stated that your initial pitch outlined like 20 issues of story. If you still have those notes, would you consider posting them somewhere?
You know what? I've thought about it. There's a couple of things. Dynamite, like you know, Dynamite just put out the Robotech Voltron series, and
right.
There's a possibility that there may be more Voltron comics in the future. I have like absolutely no knowledge of that. So, you know, one concern is that I don't want to kind of put a lot of that stuff out there. And they're moving the property and the book in different directions. You know, I don't want it to turn into a competition. You know, if they have another book that's coming out in the future, I'm a little uncomfortable with having like very detailed kind of plot notes of exactly what I would have done, you know, to kind of help people compare the two. You know, I don't think that's too productive, but the other thing is that I'm still kind of nursing this crazy, insane idea that maybe I'll be able to finish this story somewhere down the line. Like, I haven't completely, which is why the 12th issue ends the way it does. It ends, but it doesn't completely end.
It could go anywhere.
Exactly. There was some thought about doing basically like an issue that was set in, you know, like a year or two in the future after everything had happened, like after they had like the big confrontation with the Third Sphere and the team up with all of the Voltrons, and after the team finds out that Keith basically faked Sven's death and didn't tell anybody.
Right.
So there was some discussion about doing it like that, but I still have this kind of crazy, insane notion that I might be able to finish this story someday. So that's another thing that kind of prevents me from putting all of it out there. I'll tell you guys certain elements and stuff, and maybe I'll tell Grant to get at me privately. Maybe I'll send him some excerpts, just me to him. But I wouldn't put it online for a couple of reasons.
I understand.
But the primary thing is that there's some insane part of me that thinks like, you know, hey, maybe a few years down the line, I'll be able to return to it and finish it. So I don't want to have told everybody what was going to happen.
Right. That's fine.
Yeah.
His next question is the first arc was pretty ambitious, hitting readers with an interpretation of the Voltron mythos that was a bit different than expected.
Mm-hmm.
If you were given a do-over, would you rethink that approach, like perhaps easing readers in with something more familiar?
You know, I'm pretty comfortable with the decisions that we made overall. But like I said before, I guess the answer to the question is maybe. If I had a chance to do it over again, I might have chosen to either go with a more of a Voltron Begins story, which is what I was trying to work up to in year one.
Right.
Or a crazy idea that I kind of debated, like maybe I should have started the series with 10 lions. Like that would have been really shocking and off-putting to kind of start the series with the, you know, with the fight between the two Voltron units on the surface of the moon. So,
well, you did blow up the moon.
I did blow up the moon. It was, I have a moon thing. I don't know what it is. I have a, like some kind of, incredible fascination with the moon. There's something that's very kind of mysterious and alluring about the moon to me. And if you look at, there's a couple of different books that I've written that have had things happening to the moon. Either the moon blows up or the moon, like, I think I had a sentient sun in Miranda Mercury. So it's kind of a strange theme, you know.
Well, you finished the job that Marvin the Martian had started.
Yes. But see, the thing was, I blew up the moon, but before I did that, I gave Earth two moons.
Yes, that's so, right. There was a second moon.
So that, you know, I thought that would kind of make up for the fact that I was planning to wreck one. So I'm like, oh, well, maybe I should give him a second one. I think that there was some kind of there was an article that came out around the time that I was doing the first couple of scripts that kind of theorized that Earth may have had a second moon at some time, you know, like earlier in its lifespan. So I saw that and I was like, oh, you know, maybe I can incorporate that into Voltron. I'll give us another moon since I'm going to explode the other one in issue 7. So I guess the, you know, to answer Grant, you know, yes and no. I am proud of the stuff that we did, but do I think that I made it easy on myself by starting out with that Zarkon story? Probably not. But again, if you follow my work, I tend not to make things easy on myself. I mean, Miranda Mercury is a book that started out with issue 295. So, you know, sometimes, you know, you just have to take the risks sometimes and see what happens.
All right. Well, his third question is, will the next Miranda Mercury series be so good that it cures cancer?
Volume 3. we'll get that. We're going to try to get that worked out by volume 3.
Yeah, I'm sure you go.
But volume 2 is very good.
Okay.
Though, but will not cure cancer. But get back to us.
Okay. Our next questions are from one of your Philippine fans, Anna De Vera. She says, "Kamusta," which means how are you? Big fan girl. She says, "Hi," from the Philippines.
Okay.
If you had more issues to work with, what else would you have wanted to add to your story? Any more explosive reveals, or maybe you have wanted to explore more on those you've already had out there?
Well, we were basically building up to a huge kind of Voltron war that was basically several cool, awesome Voltron units teaming up to beat back a common enemy of Earth and Planet Doom. So that was ultimately where the story was going to go. I'll talk about this a little later, but there was going to be some interesting things coming up between Keith and Allura and their relationship and the fact that they're both lying and keeping secrets from the other. There was going to be some interesting developments there.
It all works out great when people don't tell each other things, right?
Yeah. It, you know, I kind of wanted it to feel like mom and dad are keeping secrets, you know, like mom and dad are keeping secrets from, you know, the kids and from each other. Mm-hmm. And it was never going to turn out well. And they were going to have, they're going to have some rocky moments in the future. And you put Lance in the middle of that and, you know, fireworks. So those are some of the things we had. So we, you know, you guys, there was a Voltron war. There was the reignition of the Keith, Allura, Lance kind of triangle.
Was there Vehicle Voltron planned?
Yes, Vehicle Voltron was going to be part of the huge Voltron war.
Right.
And we were also going to have we're also going to have a really cool magical duel between Keith and Lotor before they enter into an uneasy alliance once they realize that both of them want almost the same thing. And you're going to have some hard times for Hunk as well, unfortunately.
All right. Another question that she has. There were those who weren't too fond of your style for this comic series and booed to them. What did you think of them? How did you deal with them? What advice would you give others, like writers, illustrators, etc., when dealing with negative comments?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that overall, you always have to keep some perspective. It's just like when we were talking about Star Wars earlier. Right. A lot of us have a very intense, fanatical, I think fanatical is a good word sometimes, connection to these things, right? And everyone has written Star Wars Episode 7 in their head. Just like, you know, we all wrote Voltron episodes in our head for in between episodes or what happened in the future. And everyone is going to have a slightly different interpretation of what the characters and what the world is supposed to be. And and everyone's perspective is valid. I mean, we all come into these properties and these stories and these characters in different ways. And you just have to, I mean, I knew before I started that not every single Voltron fan was going to like Zarkon being human. I mean, it was a very easy, it was a departure, and I'm not going to pretend that it wasn't, you know, that it wasn't a departure. And for some people, they accepted it and they thought it was cool and interesting, and other people didn't. And that's, you know, that's completely fine. But, you know, I learned a long time ago. I learned when I was doing my column, I got into a very heated, intense argument with someone that said something derogatory about one of my columns. And when I stepped back from it and I kind of looked at the transcript, you know, I felt pretty embarrassed and ashamed that I had participated in it. So that's one thing that I always promised myself that I just wasn't going to do. I'm not going to, you know, not to say that I'm going to ignore any criticism of the work, because I'm not going to do that. But I'm not going to get into an argument with someone about it. You know,
okay.
You say you appreciate the feedback. You know, sorry you don't like it. You know, maybe if you keep reading a couple of issues, maybe you'll see something that'll grab you, that'll grab hold of you, and you'll feel great about. But, you know, overall, I think that that's the best way to deal with it. You have to keep some perspective, and you have to keep a level head, and you're expected to keep a level head. I mean, everyone can remember a story of when, you know, their favorite writer or artist or athlete, you know, completely flew off the handle and embarrassed themselves because someone said, you know, something bad about them. So, you know,
you mean like Sean Penn?
Yeah, it's a great example. I mean, there's something that you can learn even from negative criticism, as long as it's constructive and as long as it's reasonable. I think that there's a very reasonable way to kind of criticize something that doesn't turn into a personal attack. And that's far easier to deal with than someone that's just, you know, calling you names. And in this particular instance, there were some Voltron fans, even on the forums, that didn't really enjoy the comic and, you know, and were vocal about it. But I never thought that I never thought it was personal. It never felt personal to me. There was never, you know, like, you should never write again, you know, I wish they had gotten someone different, you know. So as long as the, you know, it's just something that you just have to, you know, to learn to deal with. And it takes practice, and it usually takes a mistake. It basically, wow. It usually takes you reacting the wrong way to it one time before you're, you know, before you kind of, you know, recalibrate yourself and like, okay, I'm not going to do that ever again, because it's just not productive. You just, you know, thank them for taking a chance on the book and telling them that you hope that they'll enjoy it in the future. And that's pretty much all you can do. But you just have to know that when you're dealing with a character like Voltron or Batman or Spider-Man or any of these beloved characters, it is just, it's impossible to please everyone. It's just, right. It's just not going to happen. And I
know there are people out there, celebrities that have Twitter accounts and stuff like that, like you, where they would leave themselves vulnerable, you know, to attacks like that if they kept on, you know, having conversations, extended conversations over Twitter with one person in particular at any time.
Right.
And there are actually publicists that you know, actually tell them, you know, you really shouldn't do this. You should just, like, you know, try to use Twitter for the publicity and not really have interactions with the fans. But I think, you know, there's a balance where you can, you know, actually have the interactions with the fans without stepping over the line.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's possible. I think a lot of people are doing it the right way. And you also have to recognize that in a business like comics, you're selling the work, but you're also selling yourself. So
right. You
can't just lock yourself in a room and write the scripts and just send them out in the world and that's the end of it. You have to, you know, you have to talk to people, you have to engage with people. And fortunately, that's something that has never been a huge issue for me. I mean, if you're watching your time right now, you know, it's talking has never been a problem. For me,
I could see that.
yeah, I know.
And I got to tell you, all these Voltron fans really appreciate it. Really.
I think it's important. And, you know, I'm a fan of the material, too. I mean, I like talking to like-minded people. You know, I like talking to other people that, you know, kind of have a crush on, you know, Commander Keith. I mean, because I can understand that, you know, I love this character too. So I can, you know, I can really understand that and really plug into that. And you just have to, you really have to have a thick skin. And something personally I do, I try not to get too high or too low on my own work. You know, never think that you're too big to be, you know, for someone to say something bad about you and your work. You know, don't get it in your head that, you know, I'm going to be the writer that the entire world likes. It's just, it's not going to happen. You know, I just try to keep it calm, try to keep it, you know, regulated, you know, don't get high, don't get too low. Have more interactions with the people that enjoy the work than people that don't, you know, don't
right.
waste your time arguing with people that hate the book, you know, interact with the people that do like the book, you know,
right.
acknowledge the people that don't like the book, but don't spend the entirety of your time, you know, defending the work. Because as far as you know, I mean, there are just some people, if it's not the story that they have in their head, they're not going to like it. You know, that's just part of it.
Right.
And, you know, I think, you know, I don't think that there were that many detractors, you know, of what we were doing. I felt pretty good about the response we were getting from the hardcore fans. And, you know, I enjoyed interacting with the people that love the book.
Okay. Well, we have four more questions left from the fans. And the next one is from Cubbyberry.
Okay.
Since each of your three volumes has a different artist, how did you choose your artists for the comics?
Oh, okay. That's actually, the majority of that was done by Dynamite. The one artist that I did have some influence over was Craig Cermak, who illustrated Voltron Year One. I've known Craig personally for a number of years. I mean, I've known him since he was a teenager, actually. And he's, the only thing that he's ever wanted to do is draw comics. And, you know, so I've been able to watch his work progress and, you know, get better over the years. And he had just graduated from the Kubert School out in New Jersey. I know a lot of comic fans are familiar with the Kubert School, but we started talking about doing, you know, Voltron Year One. I thought he was ready for a book like that. And I thought that we would have a fantastic time working on it together. And we did. Dynamite selected Ariel Padilla and N. Stephen Harris, even though I'm actually pretty close friends with Stephen Harris, but he actually got attached to the book before I even knew it. And they're like, okay. Yeah, you know, Stephen Harris is going to do it. I was like, oh, that's awesome. I love him. We're friends. So I didn't have quite as much control over that. Dynamite basically did the lion's share of that. But I did actively recruit and recommend Craig for Year One. And the guys at Dynamite kind of, you know, put him through his paces to see how he was going to, you know, react to having kind of like editorial presence and corrections and things of that nature. And he did well, and they let him draw the series. And it was fantastic. It was a great experience. And I think that because of our relationship outside of the book, I think that Year One has a lot of strong work from the both of us. And then also something else to consider is that I started Year One when I was like 3 or 4 scripts into the main series, which is right around the time where I really started to feel extremely confident about what I was doing and about the direction the book was going in. You know, I really started to kind of feel it and kind of own it. So around that time, that's when we started Year One. So mentally, I was a lot further ahead when I started that series versus the main series. Like, I think the first issue of Year One is a much stronger first issue than the main series. And that's because I had already written a couple of scripts. And, you know, and that's always an important thing to me. You know, I just wanted to get better. I wanted to keep getting better, and I think that the last Voltron script that I turned in, which was for issue 12, I think it was a lot stronger than the first one that I turned in. And so that gives me a good feeling about the work that we did, because I feel like it gained steam. I felt like it improved, and I think it turned into a better product. You know, every month we put one out. You know, we would learn something that we could then take to the next issue.
Yeah. All right. Well, the second question by Cubby Berry is, given that your hot K&A pairing solidified, the hot K&A pairing solidified Keith and Allura's pairing into official canon, that K&A are truly together as a couple,
mm-hmm.
where would you take K&A in the future? What would their roles be individually as well as a couple?
Well, down the road, I touched on this a little bit, but I'll expand a little. Down the road, Big Trouble. big Trouble for Keith and Allura and their kind of long-term relationship, just because they're keeping secrets. And I know that was a big theme throughout my entire run. Secrets, the price of secrets, keeping secrets, and what that does to your relationships. And it was gonna be trouble. You know, it was gonna be trouble for Keith and Allura. And let's just say that with Keith having intentionally isolated himself from the rest of the group and sending Allura off into space with Lance. It, you know, not really a smart move on him. So, not to say that, you know, and again, you know, I won't tell you exactly how it was going to play out, because you never know. I might get to do it.
But, right. You might throw a twist in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah. But there was trouble ahead. Let's just say that, you know, Keith and Allura were headed for some rough times, and their relationship was going to be in a much different space at the end of my run than it was when they started.
Okay. All right. Casey Snyder on Twitter at TribalGirl1. She asks, how would Keith's secret mission have ended?
Oh, good question. Good question. Well, what I had planned for Keith was for Keith to become a little more immersed in the world of magic, which was going to be a huge change for him. I felt emotionally that would be an interesting story. You know, you take a character who is very, you know, he's very tactile, you know, he believes in things that he can touch and things that he can see. And this whole magic thing was just going to be a major, major adjustment for him. And I think you saw a little of that in the final issue we did, where Sid just kind of has this idea that Keith is not really devoting himself to this this idea of magic and this the kind of the principles of magic as much as he needs to. And so We were going to see a lot more of that. We were going to see kind of an integration of kind of Keith's training and his kind of special forces background, along with a lot of magic, and seeing kind of how that changed him and how he could reconcile having to keep one foot in both of those worlds. So, like I said, one of the things that I'll definitely, you know, I definitely revealed earlier was that him and Lotor were headed for a really cool magical throwdown before they basically kiss and make up and figure out that they have a common enemy.
Okay. And last but not least, Tara Scully on Twitter, Hoofbeats99. What was the cause of Romel's death, and what made you decide to kill her off?
This is also a good question. You know, I was actually going to reveal exactly what there were. I was of two minds of it. I kind of wanted to reveal what exactly happened to her, but I also didn't want to, because I felt that it would be kind of gratuitous in a way. Mm-hmm. And there was also something that I was very sensitive to, this idea where, you know, you kill or you abuse a female character or kind of love interest in order to further motivate the male hero. So I wanted to be very sensitive to things like that. And for a while, I kind of went back and forth on whether or not, you know, we should actually kill her, or maybe we should just kind of incapacitate her. Maybe she's lost. Maybe she's kind of in a coma or something. But to me, it was important that someone basically had to pay a price, unfortunately. And Sven was the one that was going to have to pay that price, because he was on the outside. You know, I really wanted to play with this idea that there was no out for him. There is no retirement. There was no, I'm going to leave it all behind. You know, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I wanted to kind of show that was a very naive stance of him to take. And because he took that stance, he lost Romel. And because of that showed him that he's not going to be able to just sit on the sidelines. He's not going to be able to sit it out and leave it to somebody else to take care of. So that was the motivation behind doing it. And it was just one of those things where if she was lost, if she was in a coma, would he have shot Zarkon 19 times? No, and it was
probably
answer,
not.
The answer was no. And yeah. in order to kind of justify how he felt about Zarkon, in order to justify what he did that kind of brought him back into the main story and put him back onto the radar, it needed to be something that was pretty transformative and pretty awful. And unfortunately, you know, that meant that that Ramel couldn't stay. But I did go back and forth about, you know, I don't want anything that I did in regards to the characters and changing them or killing them or giving them a, you know, kind of a new love interest or a new relationship. You know, there was a lot of thought that went into it, and it's not something that we just did because, you know, we thought it was, you know, because we thought it was, you know, controversial or we thought it was whatever. I mean, if that was the case, we would have actually showed what happened to Ramel, you know, if we wanted to just kind of court controversy or kind of, you know, kind of stoke the flames of, you know, of the hardcore fan, you know, just to kind of get them upset about stuff. So, you know, I wanted her to die horribly and tragically, but I didn't really know how I felt about showing it on panel. And I don't know that we would have ever shown it on panel. We may have had Sven kind of do a kind of flashback or something to kind of tell what happened in his own words. But
look at the anguish in his eyes.
Yeah,
as she's being killed.
Yeah, yeah, something like that. But Sven just kind of drew the short straw on that because I needed him back into the story. And there needed to be a really good reason for him to come back to the team or come back into the fold. And it had to be something that was very significant. And that was the most significant thing that could have happened to him and with him to kind of, spark him to get back into the mix of things. So,
okay.
But I love Sven, and, you know, I hated doing awful things to him, both in that series and in year one. You know, I did some awful things to him and kind of broke him down into tiny pieces in year one. But he was always going to come back. He was always going to have a big role. And, you know, I guess I'll go ahead and tell people at the end of my run, Keith was not going to be leading the team anymore.
Okay.
Sven was going to be back in the commander's chair.
Oh, wow.
At the very end.
Boy, that's something a lot of the Sven fans would have loved to have seen.
Yeah, yeah. So, Keith, at the end of the day, you know, the secrets demand a price, and keeping those secrets was going to kind of alienate him a little bit from his friends, at least for a little while.
Okay.
So, you know, it's kind of one of those things. At the end of the day, he is one of the big reasons that, you know, the Third Sphere is ultimately defeated, and that Doom and Eris and Earth get to embrace a new relationship of, I don't want to say mutual cooperation, but maybe begrudging respect.
Okay.
But in the process, Keith was going to lose a lot of the things that that meant a lot to him.
Understood. That's pretty cool.
Those are some of the broad strokes of how the story was ultimately going to play out.
Well, there you go, fans. That's the big reveal here on the Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast from Brandon Thomas.
Yep. So you keep me talking long enough, and I'll just tell you everything. That's the trick. Like, if you want to know something from me, just just keep talking to him for long enough, and eventually he won't be able to hold it in anymore, and he'll just give it all away. So that was going to be the end.
So this was just one long interrogation, huh?
Yeah. Keith was going to save everything and also lose everything.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us on the Let's Voltron podcast. This has been great.
Thank you. Thank you for asking.
There's a lot of people that have been waiting to hear your side of the story on all of this.
Yeah, I understand.
So to have it in this kind of a capacity where we get to see it for this much that we covered here is just awesome.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I hope they like it. I hope they get a kick out of it.
So if people want to continue the conversation with you about Voltron and everything you wrote after this, can they do that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm sure this will spark some even more questions, especially, I'm sorry, like the Keith and Allura people might not like me as much anymore after that. It's like, there's trouble coming and Lance is there. So, you know.
Okay. So where can they reach you then?
Well, easiest way to reach me through my Twitter account @MirandaMercury, which again is coming back. Volume 2 is in production. Stay tuned for more details on that. And my Facebook page, I'm incredibly active on. So I'm around. And then also my blog is The Fiction House. It's on WordPress. So it's fictionhouse.wordpress.com.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see everyone next time on
Let's Voltron!